Hello, I'm Marlene Saeed. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, as Big Pharma refuses to share its COVID vaccine secrets, the World Health Organization hires a South African lab to crack the mRNA code. We find out why Pfizer is prepared to share the recipe for its antiviral pill, but not the vaccine. And return to the skies. Battered by the pandemic, the airline industry hopes to put the billions in losses behind it. We talk to the former chief executive of British Airways about the industry's recovery.
I'm Doris Ojebari at the Doha International Airport, where this experimental Boeing 777X is paying a fleeting visit. It's already behind schedule. I'll explain why some of its biggest customers want to know when it will be delivered.
A real game changer. That's how Pfizer's chief executive, Albert Bourla, describes its COVID-19 oral antiviral drug. The pharmaceutical giant claims it cuts the risk of hospitalization and death by 89%. Global markets have welcomed the news of the additional weapon in the fight against COVID, a virus which in 19 months has crippled economies and led to the deaths of more than 5 million people. But unsurprisingly, campaigners are already raising concerns that the rich world will once again corner the antiviral market. Let's crunch some numbers. The biggest makers of vaccines have seen supersized sales of their COVID jabs. Pfizer expects sales of $36 billion this year, and AstraZeneca foresees revenue of just over $2 billion. Now, take a look at this chart from Bloomberg using data from health intelligence analyst Airfinity. Of the 2-plus billion doses of vaccines produced by Pfizer-BioNTech, the vast majority, shown here in chunky dark blue, went to high-income countries, with less than 150 million doses to low-income countries. That is 150 million out of 2 billion. Compare that to the vaccine produced by AstraZeneca. Lower-middle-income countries, like India, shown here in light blue, received the vast majority of the 2.2 billion doses produced. So why does this matter? Well, apart from the obvious health reasons, the Economist Intelligence Unit predicts that countries that vaccinate less than 60% of their populations by the middle of 2022 will suffer economic losses of over $2 trillion between 2022 and 2025. Well, it looks like history is now repeating itself, and wealthy countries are already cornering the market for COVID-19 pills. The United States has done a $2 billion deal for 3 million doses of a rival drug from Merck. Pfizer has agreements in place to sell its pill to the UK, Australia and South Korea. Pfizer's new pill could be available in early 2022 if regulatory approval is given. Probably expecting pushback, the company said it would license its pill to the UN's medicines patent pool to provide low-income countries with a cheaper option. Which is in sharp contrast to its attitude to handing over the patents for its jab, which has forced the World Health Organization to hire a lab in South Africa to crack the mRNA code. Meanwhile, BioNTech and Moderna have announced plans to set up plants on the African continent to produce their mRNA jabs. Germany's BioNTech says it would go further and start research work there for new vaccines for malaria and HIV. What does this all mean for the developing and low-income countries? I'm joined from Nairobi by Dr. Githinji Gitahi, the chief executive of Amref Health Africa. He was appointed commissioner of the Africa COVID-19 Commission by the African Union. Many thanks for joining the programme, sir. There's been huge pressure on big pharma in wealthy countries to end this vaccine inequality. But we're 19 months into the pandemic and less than 1% of all vaccines have gone to poorer countries. Why is that?
Well, it's because of greed, literally. And, you know, if you look at the imbalance that we have, which Tedros called the shocking imbalance, it is driven by trade practices, supply and demand. And therefore, the person who had the money went first to the supermarket, to the vaccine supermarket door. And that is it. So we have doses that have been stockpiled for rich countries. And now the rich countries are using those to vaccinate low-risk people and also using them for third doses. Well, poor countries are still waiting to get their hands on doses. And it's not about absence of resources. We have multilateral resources to provide vaccines to poor countries, but the doses are held by the rich countries. This is the problem.
Even when developing countries are offered vaccines at cost, they're having to take out loans to pay for these. So their debt burdens are getting worse. So what's the solution?
It's terrible because, you see, what's going on is that institutions like the World Bank, which are well-meaning, are presenting debt as a solution to receipt of vaccines and solving the equity problem. Whereas we know that actually the challenge is that COVAX, which is holding almost $10 billion to purchase vaccines for the poor countries, is unable to find any doses anywhere. So while poor countries are being forced to take debt to purchase some of the agreements of vaccines, there are vaccines that can be bought by the COVID vaccine facility and delivered to poor countries. It is an injustice because countries that have to already increase and stretch their health budgets to vaccinate their people are having now to also include debt, which means that in future, we are going to have a serious problem with the fiscal space to even finance the general health system for essential services. It's a disaster.
Dr. Kitahi, let's talk about this plan by the WHO to pay a South African company, it's called Afrigen Biologics, to attempt to replicate Moderna's COVID vaccine. What do you think of this plan? And do you think they're going to be able to do it?
Well, I think that the plan that we are hearing from WHO on Afrigen Biologics is more about learning. I don't think it has any capacity to produce the vaccines that are needed for Africa or for the world. We may get some vaccines, but it's more a learning agenda because what WHO is asking Afrigen Biologics to do is to reverse engineer an existing mRNA from Moderna so that we can use it for teaching. This is really what the issue is. And the question is as to whether it will actually be ready in time and learning in time for the COVID vaccines. The truth is, we will not get adequate COVID vaccines from this initiative by WHO and Afrigen Biologics. We will learn for future pandemics. We will prepare mRNA for other conditions, like maybe malaria vaccines. For now, even us, as AMREF Health Africa, we are asking for ending the stockpiles, ending third boosters until everyone has vaccines. And most importantly, sharing knowledge with existing manufacturers so that we can ramp up the vaccination and also sharing what people are holding. This is what our, even our own End Injustice petition is asking for. We need to take immediate action. These are long-term actions, will be good, but they can't solve the current problem. People are dying waiting for vaccines. A vaccine delayed is a vaccine denied. It costs lives.
When it comes to their new COVID-19 pill, treatment pill, Pfizer said it will allow it to be made and sold in 95 developing countries. How do you view Pfizer's willingness to share the patent to its this antiviral drug when they've been so rigid about their vaccine?
Well, it shows you that actually the key motive of these activities is actually profiteering. If you look at the amount of money that actually is being put together by companies like Pfizer, Moderna, and, well-meaning and saying they're going to put in $500 million to build a factory there, they're going to provide a license to, medicines, patents, MPP for countries to manufacture. They're making, I think between Pfizer and Moderna, they're making $93 billion of profit next year. So it is actually tokenism. And I think if they're really meaning well, they should actually say, we are going to provide our technology to any vaccine manufacturer who is willing to manufacture so that we can ramp up doses. Then we have enough for everyone, including those who want third boosters, those who want this and that. But for now, if you're holding the patents for the most necessary tool against COVID-19 right now, then providing the patent for the medicine, for anyone who wants to pick it in future, when you're holding those and selling them to rich countries because of non-transparent pricing, it is actually, it's unfair and it's dishonest.
So what do you think of these plans by Moderna and BioNTech to build plants for vaccines in Africa? Is that not a change in attitude from these companies?
Well, again, as I say, $500 million, you're trying to support, the content when you're holding millions of doses, under non-transparent pricing that you're selling to rich countries. It is a good gesture. But even up to now, I'm waiting to hear what the plan is in terms of where it's going to be manufactured. And then you're manufacturing a plant that's going to deliver 50 million doses a year, while actually in other places you're having 100 million doses a month. How is 50 million doses a year going to help the problem of access of vaccines to poor countries, including Africa? It will not. The immediate action is actually to move COVID vaccine facility and facilities like Africa Vaccine Testing ahead of the queues and actually ask those people who are stockpiling to move to the back of the queue so that we may distribute faster, even as we discuss future manufacturing. A vaccine delayed is a vaccine denied. The vaccines are needed now, not in 2023, not in 2024. We may prepare for the future, but we need the vaccines today for the people who are dying today as we speak.
I understand that, but investment is investment. And we have these new biotech hubs that are being planned for countries like Senegal and Rwanda. What does it tell us about these particular countries' ability to attract these huge manufacturers?
Well, the point that we need to make is that Africa is not asking for vaccines to be just donated to them. We have money from multilaterals. Now, these countries, Rwanda, Senegal, South Africa, Egypt, Algeria, that are actually planning to manufacture vaccines, are doing the right thing. And the thing that I'm asking for myself is that Africa should not manufacture vaccines for Africa. Africa should manufacture vaccines for the world, like India manufactured for the world. If we shift our thinking, then we move away from tokenism, saying we are going to build a small factory in Rwanda so that Africa is happy, or one small one in Senegal. We need to partner with Africa, Africa Centers for Disease Control, Africa Union, and the entire market so that we manufacture vaccines for the world in Africa, not manufacture vaccines for Africa. Then we are driving towards this thing of a ticker box, I put in $500 million in Rwanda, in Senegal, And then I have a seat in Africa. That's what we must move away from. So we are happy that there are these initiatives, but they are far from enough. They are far from adequate.
Dr. Githinji Gitahi, Chief Executive of AMREF Health Africa, also Commissioner of the Africa COVID-19 Commission by the African Union. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Qatar Airways is bringing back into service the Airbus A380 Super Jumbo more than a year after it grounded the aircraft. At the time, its chief executive, Akbar Al-Bakr, said buying the plane was a big mistake due to the high cost of running it. Well, with climate change and huge losses racked up during the pandemic, airlines are queuing up to buy more fuel-efficient planes. Al Jazeera's Dorsa Jabari has a story.
This is the world's largest twin-engine plane. The experimental Boeing 777X made a short visit to Doha's international airport as the firm attempts to boost its image. Boeing says it has sold 309 of the plane, worth more than $442 million each. The 252-foot-long passenger plane had been due to launch this year, but has been delayed by some technical difficulties. And Qatar Airways is not only one of its top customers, but it also helped develop the plane.
The reason we are always investing in new technology is to have a sustainable growth. This aeroplane is 20% more fuel efficient than the current 777, which means that we will be burning 20% less fuel, so less emissions from this aeroplane.
Boeing is looking to improve its image after its 737 MAX plane was grounded last year following two fatal crashes that killed 346 people. The grounding of the 737 MAX, which had been Boeing's best-selling plane, is estimated to have already cost the company more than $9 billion. But at this event, it's all about strengthening old bonds.
They've launched the airplane with us. They've developed the airplane with us. They've helped us design the airplane, and they're helping us improve everything around it, and that's why we're here today.
The delays in delivery have been one of the major issues for Boeing.
Airlines are desperately searching for planes that are more fuel efficient to meet higher emission targets from regulators. But this plane is already behind schedule, and some of its biggest customers, like Emirates, are not happy.
The Boeing 777X model was scheduled to be delivered to the 8 airline carriers earlier this year, but due to technical issues and concerns from regulators, it's now being pushed back till the end of 2023. A delivery date many airlines are counting on to replace their current fleet with a newer, more cost-efficient model, which appears to be the goal for the future of the aviation industry. Dorsa Jabari, Al Jazeera, Doha.
The pandemic has been unkind to the aviation industry, with 40 airlines collapsing under the financial strain. But the gloom may be lifting as borders reopen, vaccination rates increase, and passengers start to fly again. But when will the industry recover to pre-pandemic levels? Well, that's just the first of many questions my colleague Adrian Finnegan put to Willie Walsh, the Director General of the International Air Transport Association.
I'm actually more confident that we will get back to normal, but it's going to take some time. You know, we're predicting 2023, 2024, depending on where you are in the world, but we're heading in the right direction now.
OK, about 40 airlines went under during the pandemic. Yeah. Is that situation going to get worse before we reach that normal? Are you expecting others to fall by the wayside?
Unfortunately, I think some will. In fact, I'm surprised that more haven't gone at this stage. But I think the risk for some is still ahead of them, particularly as they start building up their operation again, because they'll incur costs that they haven't been incurring with their aircraft grounded. And I think getting that connection between the revenue inflow and the cost outflow is going to be critical, because cash is the thing that's everybody is worried about at the moment.
Of course, I mean, some governments in some part of the world have bailed out airlines, but not every country can afford to do that. They don't have such deep pockets, do they?
No, they don't. So we estimate a little over $200 billion has been made available to airlines from governments. Most of that has actually come in the form of employee support programs to keep people in jobs. And then the next biggest chunk of it is in terms of loans that will have to be repaid. So it hasn't been, you know, free money that's been given out to airlines. Every airline has suffered as a result of the pandemic. So a lot of work will need to be done by airlines to recover and repair the balance sheet.
It must have come as a relief to have the US open its borders, at least to some countries. I mean, does that take the pressure off, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. It's a big positive development from the 8th of November that it's reopened for 33 countries that had been prevented from flying to the US, principally in Europe. So I think that's going to generate additional momentum as well as other countries look to what the US has done. So I think in terms of signals, very, very strong signal.
What needs to happen to get us all back in the air again? I know that many people watching are itching to get flying again, to go on holiday, to go visit relatives abroad. But while some of us are managing to do that at the moment, I mean, we were talking before we started the interview about how difficult it is with all of the restrictions that are still in place in terms of vaccinations and what have you. What needs to happen?
Well, I think the key is vaccination, to be honest, because we've been arguing for some time that people who are vaccinated should be free to travel without restriction and without testing. And for those who can't access a vaccine, I think having a sensible testing regime in place, so it doesn't need to be the expensive and difficult PCR testing. You know, it's clear that the quality of antigen testing has improved significantly since the start of this pandemic. But vaccination really is the key. And we are seeing that more and more countries are allowing people who are fully vaccinated to travel.
And what about the standardisation of requirements? Because at the moment, every country has different requirements for you before you're allowed
to enter.
I mean, what role does IATA play in that? I mean, you know, is it a case of you ringing up the health minister and saying, look, we need to get this straight and to coordinate on this?
But we have been trying to do that. And we're actually seeing greater coordination now. It was the disappointing thing I felt at the beginning of this pandemic, that in effect every country went their own way. Even within Europe, where you would have expected the 27 countries in the EU to have coordinated their policies, we saw 12, 13 different regimes in place. It is going in the right direction. And in fact, one of the positives has been the development of the EU digital COVID certificate, which has now been adopted by over 50 countries. So we've been encouraging countries to have mutual recognition of passes or to adopt a single pass. And you know, it has been improving, but it is still very confusing for the average consumer who's trying to work out, what do I need to do and when do I need to do it?
And when you talk to governments, what are their main concerns?
They continue to highlight, you know, protecting the health of the nation. I think the data actually points to a regime that could be much more relaxed. I quote figures from the UK all the time, because people flying into the UK since February have had to take a PCR test after they arrive. And of the 9 million tests that were taken up to the end of September, the positivity rate was less than 1%, 0.8%. While at the same time, in the general population, the positivity rate was 7.1%. So the risk was not from people flying into the country. The risk was already in the country. Yeah. And what we've been encouraging governments to do is look at the data and make decisions based on the data rather than apply rules that may have been sensible when we were dealing with an unknown event back in February of last year.
When we were talking a few moments ago about governments bailing out airlines, you said, of course, that's not free money. That's loans. They've got to pay that back. Do you think, though, that governments, as they seek to recoup the money that they've loaned to airlines, are going to start passing on costs to passengers, to the likes of you and me, through taxation?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that is the case. And we've seen that in some countries already. The UK, for example, has increased air passenger duty, particularly for long-haul flights. So we are seeing some additional costs beginning to come back onto the consumer. And clearly, we've got to fight against that because it's unfair to start damaging the recovery. I think people will recognise that the economic contribution of aviation is significant. Aviation actually can play a major role in recovering economies around the world.
And do you think that matters to consumers, the fact that I mean, they don't necessarily see the breakdown sometimes. They just see this whopping great sum and think, well, whew, that's expensive.
Yeah, it's definitely discouraging some people, particularly when you add on top of that the cost of doing these tests. Mm. So if you have to do a PCR test, we've seen prices ranging from $27 to $270 for the same test. Mm. So, I think this is an area that will concern consumers. But the good news, exactly as you said, where restrictions are removed, then we see an immediate recovery. And that's particularly evident in domestic markets where travel restrictions in general have not been imposed.
Let's talk about sustainability. The industry, of course, in the crosshairs right now for its emissions. I mean, what is the plan, as far as you're concerned, for the industry to reduce its carbon emissions?
So we have a real challenge because there isn't a quick alternative to the fuel that we use to do jet kerosene. What we have committed to is getting to net zero by 2050 to align our targets with those of the Paris Agreement and with the targets that most governments have agreed to. In the short to medium term, we see sustainable aviation fuels. So these are fuels that are generated from other sources that can have a carbon footprint of up to 80% lower than jet kerosene.
How does the relationship work with aircraft manufacturers? I mean, do you go to the likes of Airbus and Boeing and say, we need to do this, we need to get our carbon emissions lower? Or is it the other way around? Do they come to you and they say, well, look, we've got a more efficient engine, we've got more efficient aircraft?
Yeah, it's a great question, because traditionally it has been the manufacturer coming to us and say, look, we've got a better option for you. We're now saying, actually, you're not moving fast enough. Mm. You need to do better. The aircraft and engines that are being produced today need to be more efficient. So it's pleasing to see Airbus, for example, are committing to having a hydrogen-powered aircraft, which clearly would be gross zero, no CO2 emissions, by 2035. Now, I think that's going to be challenging. But they're getting more and more confident that they can do that. But in the time frame out to 2050, we think that's going to have limited impact. It will have more significant impact beyond 2050.
Do you think there'll come a day when we can fly without emissions that will electric engines say, for instance? I mean, we've got some commercial flights now that can go halfway around the world on one sort of fuel load. Will an electric powered plane or other form of powered plane be able to do that?
Yeah, in time. Not in the 2050 timeframe, and that's why we think sustainable fuels is the answer there. But electric, hybrid electric, these will be part of the solution, particularly for shorter range flights. Mm-hmm. Hydrogen from 2035, and again, initially for short range. But beyond 2050, I think there will be technological solutions that will enable us to fly without emitting any CO2.
Living in Doha, I've been a frequent flyer with Qatar Airways for a long time. Before that, the last time we met, I was a frequent BA flyer because I was working for another organisation. Whenever I booked a ticket and you completed a purchase, you were always asked if you wished to offset the cost of your carbon footprint. And I've always wondered, what was the take-up of that like?
Very low.
Yeah?
Yeah, very low. In fact, Lufthansa disclosed some figures recently where they said it was about 1%. So when the option is provided to consumers, I think a lot of consumers look at it, but they're not actually availing of that facility.
So while they're price conscious, they're not necessarily socially conscious as well.
I think they are becoming, and consumer behaviour changes, and that's why as an industry we've got to make sure that, we are listening to what consumers are telling us. And more people are saying this is the number one item.
Willie, it's been great to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Not at all. Good to see you.
And that is our show for this week. Get in touch with us by tweeting me at Marlene Saeed. And do use the hashtag AJCTC when you do. Or drop us an email. Counter the cost at aljazeera.net is our address. But there's more for you online at aljazeera.com/ctc. That will take you straight to our page, which has entire episodes for you to catch up on. That is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Marlene Said from the whole team. Thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.